Blue Mars, Cassette 18. Late that night, however, she took Nergal aside after an outdoor feast in the cool evening air, and she told him all her fears about the latest conflict between Earth and Mars. Michelle was off talking to people. Sax sat on the bench across from them, listening silently. Jackie and the Free Mars leadership are talking a hard line, but it won't work. The Terrans won't be stopped. It could lead to war, I tell you, war. Nergal stared at her. He still took her seriously, God bless his beautiful soul, and Maya put her arm around him like she would have her own son and squeezed him hard, hard. What do you think we should do? He asked. We have to keep Mars open. We have to fight for that, and you have to be part of it. We need you more than anyone else. You were the one that had the greatest impact during our visit to Earth. In essence, you're the most important Martian in Terran history because of that visit. They still write books and articles about what you do. Did you know that? There's a feral movement getting very strong in North America and Australia and growing everywhere. The Turtle Island people have almost entirely reorganized the American West. It's scores of feral co-ops now. They're listening to you. And it's the same here. I've been doing what I can. We just fought them in the election campaign for the whole length of the Grand Canal, and I tried to counter Jackie a bit. That worked a little, I think, but it's bigger than Jackie. She's gone to Arishka, and of course it makes sense for the Reds to oppose immigration. They think that will help protect their precious rocks. So Free Mars and the Reds may be in the same camp for the first time because of this issue. They'll be very hard to beat, but if they aren't... Nergal nodded. He took her point. She could have kissed him. She squeezed him across the shoulders, leaned over and kissed his cheek, nuzzled his neck. I love you, Nergal. And I love you, he said with an easy laugh, looking a bit surprised. But look, I don't want to get involved in a political campaign. No, listen, I agree that it's important, and I agree we should keep Mars open and help Earth out through the population surge. That's what I've always said. That's what I told them when we were there. But I won't get into the political institutions. I can't. I'll make my contribution the way I did before, do you understand? I cover a lot of ground. I see a lot of people. I'll talk to them. I'll start giving talks to meetings again. I'll do what I can at that level. Maya nodded. That would be great, Nergal. That's the level we need to reach anyway. Sax cleared his throat. Nergal, have you ever met the mathematician Bao? No, I don't think so. Ah. Sax slumped back into his reverie. Maya talked for a while about the problems she and Michelle had discussed that day. How immigration worked as a time machine, bringing up little islands of the past into the present. That was John's worry, too, and now it's happening. Nergal nodded. We have to have faith in the Areophany and in the Constitution. They have to live by it once they're here. The government should insist on that. Yes, but the people, the natives, I mean, some kind of assimilationist ethic. We need to draw everyone in. Yes. Okay, Maya, I'll see what I can do. He smiled at her, then suddenly he was falling asleep right before their eyes. Maybe we can pull it off one more time, eh? Maybe. I've got to get flat. Good night. I love you. They sailed northwest from minus one, and the island slipped under the horizon like a dream of ancient Greece, and they were on the open sea again with its high, broad, sloppy groundswell. Hard trade winds poured out of the northeast for every hour of their passage, tearing off white caps that made the dark purple water look even darker. Wind and water made a continuous roar. It was hard to hear. Everything had to be shouted. The crew gave up speech entirely and worked on setting the maximum amount of sail possible, forcing the ship's AI to deal with their enthusiasm. The mast sails stretched or tightened with each gust like birds' wings, so that the wind had a visual component to match the invisible kinetics of Maya's buffeted skin, and she stood in the bow looking up and back, taking it all in. On the third day, the wind blew even harder, and the boat got up to its hydroplaning speed, the hull lifting up onto a flat section at the stern, and then skipping over the waves, knocking up far more spray than was comfortable for anyone on deck. Maya retreated to the first cabin, where she could look out the bow windows and witness the spectacle. Such speed! Occasionally, crew members would come in sopping to catch their breath and suck down some Java. One of them told Maya that they were adjusting their course to take account of the Hellas current. "This sea's the biggest example ever of the Coriolis force on a bathtub drain, it being round, and in the latitudes where trade winds push it the same way as the Coriolis force, so it's swirling clockwise around minus one island like a great big whirlpool. We have to adjust for it big time or we'll make landfall halfway to Hell's Gate." The strong winds held, and flying along like they were, hydroplaning for most of the day, it took them only 4 days to sail across their radius of the Hellas Sea. On the fourth afternoon, the mast sails feathered in, and the hull fell back into the water, rolling in the whitecaps. To the north, land appeared over all the horizon at once, the rim of the Great Basin, like a mountain range without any peaks, a giant berm of a slope, looking like the inner wall of a crater, which of course it was, but so much bigger than any normal crater that one could only barely see the arcing of the circle, exactly that big, which struck Maya as beautiful somehow. And as they closed on the land and then coasted westward toward Odessa, their landfall had still been east of the town despite their adjustment for the clockwise current, she could, by climbing up the halyards into the wind, see the beach that the sea had created, a wide strand backed by grass-covered dunes with creek mouths cutting through here and there. A handsome coast, and near the outskirts of Odessa, part of Odessa's handsomeness then, part of her town. Off to the west, the rugged peaks of the Hellespontus Montes began to poke over the waves, distant and small, very different in character from the smooth northern rise. So they had to be close. Maya climbed up farther in the halyards, and there it was, on the rise of the northern slope, the topmost rows of parks and buildings, all green and white, turquoise and terracotta. And then the big bowed middle of town, like an enormous amphitheater looking down on the stage of the harbor, which came over the horizon, white lighthouse first, then the statue of Arcady, then the breakwater, then the thousand masts of the marina and the jumble of roofs and trees behind the stained concrete of the Cornish seawall. Odessa. She scampered down the halyard like a crew member, almost, and hugged a few of them and Michelle, feeling herself grin, feeling the wind pour over them. They came into the harbor, and the sails furled into their masts like touched snails. They puttered into a slip and walked down a gangplank and along the dock, up through the marina and into the Cornish Park, and there they were. The blue trolley still clang-clanged on the street behind the park. Maya and Michelle walked down the Cornish hand in hand, looking at all the food vendors and the small outdoor cafes across the street. All the names seemed new, not a single one the same, but that was restauranteering for you. They all looked much as they had before, and the city rising up terrace by terrace behind the seafront was just as they remembered it. There's the Odeon. There's the Center. That's where I worked for Deep Waters. I wonder what they all do now. I think maintaining sea level keeps a good number of them busy. There's always some kind of water work.
True.
And then they came to the old Praxis apartment building, its walls now mostly ivy-covered, the white stucco discolored, the blue shutters faded. In need of a bit of work, as Michelle said, but Maya loved it that way. Old. There on the third floor she spotted their old kitchen window and balcony, and Spencer's there beside it. Spencer himself was supposed to be inside. And they went in the gate, and said hello to the new concierge, and indeed Spencer was inside, sort of. He had died that afternoon. It shouldn't have mattered so much. Maya hadn't seen Spencer Jackson in years. She had never seen that much of him, even when he lived next door. Never known him at all well. No one had. Spencer was one of the least comprehensible of the first 100, which was saying a lot. His own man, his own life. And he had lived as part of the surface world under an assumed identity, a spy working for the security Gestapo in Casey Valles for almost 20 years, until the night they had blown the town away and rescued Sachs and Spencer as well. 20 years as someone else, with a false past and no one to talk to. What would that do to one? But then Spencer had always been withdrawn, private, self-contained. So maybe it hadn't mattered as much to him. He had seemed all right in their years in Odessa, always in therapy with Michelle, of course, and a very heavy drinker at times, but easy to have as a neighbor, a good friend, quiet, solid, reliable in his ways. And he certainly had continued to work. His production with the Bogdanovist designers had never flagged, neither during his double life or after. A great designer. And his pen sketches were beautiful. But what would 20 years of duplicity do to you? Maybe all his identities had become assumed. Maya had never thought about it. She couldn't imagine it. And now, packing Spencer's things in his empty apartment, she wondered that she had never even tried before, that somehow Spencer had managed to live in such a way that one didn't even wonder about him. It was a very strange accomplishment. Crying, she said to Michelle, "You have to wonder about everybody." He only nodded. Spencer had been one of his best friends. And then in the next few days, an amazing number of people came to Odessa for the funeral. Sachs, Nadia, Mikhail, Zeke and Nazik, Roald, Coyote, Mary, Ursula, Marina and Vlad, Jurgen and Sibylla, Steve and Marion, George and Edvard, Samantha. Really, it was like a convocation of the remaining 100 and associated Issei. And Maya stared around at all their old familiar faces and realized with a sinking heart that they would be meeting like this for a long time to come. Gathering from around the world each time one fewer, in a final game of musical chairs, until one day one of them would get a call and realize they were the last one left. A horrible fate. But not one that Maya expected to have to endure. She would die before that, surely. The quick decline would get her, or something else. She would step in front of a trolley if she had to. Anything to avoid such a fate. Well, not anything. To step in front of a trolley would be both too cowardly and too brave at one and the same time. She trusted she would die before it came to that. Ah, never fear. Death could be trusted to show up. No doubt, well before she wanted it. Maybe the final survivor of the first 100 wouldn't be such a bad thing anyway. New friends, a new life. Wasn't that what she was searching for now? So that these sad old faces were just a hindrance to her? She stood grimly through the short memorial service and the quick eulogies. Those who spoke looked somewhat perplexed as to what they could say. A big crowd of engineers had come from Da Vinci, Spencer's colleagues from his design years. Clearly a lot of people had been fond of him. It was surprising, even though Maya had been fond of him herself. Curious that such a hidden man could evoke such a response. Perhaps they had all projected onto his blankness, made their own Spencer, and loved him as part of themselves. They all did that anyway. That was life. But now he was gone. They went down to the harbor, and the engineers let loose a helium balloon, and when it reached 100 meters, Spencer's ashes began to spill out in a slow trickle. part of the haze, the blue of the sky, the brass of sunset. In the days that followed, the crowd dispersed, and Maya wandered Odessa, nosing through used furniture shops and sitting on benches on the Corniche, watching the sun bounce over the water. It was lovely to be in Odessa again, but she felt the funereal chill of Spencer's death much more than she would have expected. It cast a pall over even the beauty of this most beautiful town. It reminded her that in coming back here and moving into the old building, they were attempting the impossible, trying to go back, trying to deny time's passing. Hopeless. Everything was passing. Everything they did was the last time they would ever do it. Habits were such lies, lulling them into the feeling that there was something that was lasting, when really nothing lasted. This was the last time she would ever sit on this bench. If she came down to the Corniche tomorrow and sat on this same bench, it would again be the last time, and there would again be nothing lasting about it. Last time after last time. So it would go on and on, always one final moment after the next, finality following finality in seamless, endless succession. She couldn't grasp it, really. Words couldn't say it. Ideas couldn't articulate it, but she could feel it like the edge of a wave front pushing ever outward, or a constant wind in her mind rushing things along so fast it was hard to think, hard to really feel them. At night in bed she would think, this is the last time for this night, and she would hug Michelle hard, hard, as if she could stop it happening if she squeezed hard enough. Even Michelle... Even the little dual world they had built. Oh, Michelle, she said, frightened. It goes so fast. He nodded, mouth pursed. He no longer tried to give her therapy. He no longer tried always and ever to put the brightest face on things. He treated her as an equal now, and her moods as some kind of truth which was only her due. But sometimes... She missed being comforted. Michelle offered no rebuttal, however, no hopeful comment. Spencer had been his friend. Before, in the Odessa years, when he and Maya had fought, he had sometimes gone to Spencer's to sleep, and no doubt to talk late into the night over glasses of whiskey. If anyone could draw out Spencer, it would have been Michelle. Now he sat on the bed looking out the window, a tired old man. They never fought anymore. Maya felt it would probably do her some good if they did. Clear out the cobwebs, get charged again. But Michelle wouldn't respond to any provocation. He himself didn't care to fight. And as he was no longer giving her therapy, he wouldn't do it for her sake either. No, they sat side by side on the bed. If someone walked in, Maya thought, they would observe a couple so old and worn that they didn't even bother to speak anymore, just sat together, alone in their own thoughts. Well, Michelle said after the longest time, but here we are. Maya smiled. The hopeful remark made at last, at great effort. He was a brave man. And quoting the first words spoken on Mars, John had had a knack in a funny way for saying things. Here we are. It was stupid, really. And yet, might he have meant something more than the John obvious assertion? Had it been more than the thoughtless exclamation that anyone might make? Here we are, she repeated, testing the phrase on her tongue. On Mars. First an idea, than a place. And now they were in a nearly empty apartment bedroom, not the one they had lived in before, but a corner apartment, with views out big windows to south and west. The great curve of sea and mountains said Odessa, nowhere else. The old plaster walls were stained, the wood floors dark and gleaming. It had taken many years of life to achieve that patination. Living room through one door, hall to the kitchen through the other. They had a mattress on a frame, a couch, some chairs, some unopened boxes, their things from before pulled out of storage. Odd how a few sticks of furniture hung around like that. It made her feel better to see them. They would unpack, deploy the furniture, use it until it became invisible. Habit would once again cloak the naked reality of the world. And thank God for that. Soon after that, the global elections were held, and Free Mars and its cluster of small allies were returned as a supermajority in the global legislature. Its victory wasn't as large as had been expected, however, and some of its allies were grumbling and looking around for better deals. Mangala was a hotbed of rumors. One could have spent days at the screen reading columnists and analysts and provocateurs hashing over the possibilities. With the immigration issue on the table, the stakes were higher than they had been in years, and the kicked anthill behavior of Mangala proved it. The outcome of the election for the next executive council remained very much in doubt, and there were rumors that Jackie was fending off challenges from within the party. Maya shut off her screen, thinking hard. She gave a call to Athos, who looked surprised to see her, then quickly polite. He had been elected representative from the Nepenthes Bay towns and was in Mangala working hard for the Greens, who had made a fairly strong showing and had a solid group of representatives and many interesting new alliances. "You should run for the executive council," Maya told him. Now he was really surprised. "Me?"
"You."
Maya wanted to tell him to go look in a mirror and think it over, but bit her tongue. "You made the best impression in the campaign, and a lot of people want to support a pro-Earth policy and don't know who to back. You're their best bet. You might even go talk to Mars first and see if you can pull them out of the Free Mars Alliance. Promise them a moderate stance and a voice with a counselor and long-range reddish sympathies." Now he was looking worried. If he was still involved with Jackie and he ran for the council, then he would be in big trouble on that front, especially if he went after Mars first as well. But after Peter's visit, he might not be as concerned about that as he would have been during the bright nights on the canal. Maya let him go stew about it. There was only so much you could do with these people. Although she didn't want to reconstruct her previous life in Odessa, she did want to work. And at this point, hydrology had overtaken ergonomics, and politics, obviously, as her primary area of expertise. And she was interested in the water cycle in the Hellas Basin, curious to see how the work was changing now that the basin was full. Michel had his practice, and was going to get involved with the first settlers project that had been mentioned to him in Rhodos. She would have to do something. And so after they had unpacked and furnished the new apartment, she went looking for deep waters. The old offices were now a seafront apartment, very smart, and the name was no longer in the directories. But Diana was, living in one of the big group houses in the upper town, and happy to see Maya show up at her door, happy to go out to lunch with her and tell her all about the current situation in the local water world, which was still her work. Most of the Deep Waters people moved straight into the Hellas Sea Institute. This was an interdisciplinary group composed of representatives from all the agricultural co-ops and water stations around the basin, as well as fisheries, the University of Odessa, and all the towns on the coast, and all the settlements higher in the basin's extensive rimland watersheds. The seaside towns in particular were intensely interested in stabilizing the sea's level at just above the old -1 kilometer contour, just a few score meters higher than the North Sea's current level. "They don't want sea level to change by even a meter," Diana said, "if it can be helped. And the Grand Canal is useless as a runoff canal to the North Sea because the locks need water flowing in both directions. So it's a matter of balancing the inflow from aquifers and rainfall with evaporation loss. That's been fine so far, Evaporation loss is slightly higher than the precipitation into the watershed, so every year they draw down the aquifers a few meters. Eventually, that'll be a problem, but not for a long time, because there's a good aquifer reserve left, and they're refilling a bit now, and may more in the future. We're hoping precipitation levels will also rise over time, and they have been so far, so they probably will continue to for a while longer, anyway. I don't know. That's the main worry, anyway. That the atmosphere will suck off more than the aquifers can resupply. Won't the atmosphere finally hydrate fully? Maybe. No one is really sure how humid it will get. Climate studies are a joke, if you ask me. The global models are just too complex. There are too many unknown variables. What we do know is that the air is still pretty arid, and it seems likely it will get more humid. So everybody believes what they want, and goes out there and tries to please themselves, and the environmental courts keep track of it all as best they can. They don't forbid anything? Oh yeah, but only big heat pumpers. The small stuff they don't mess with, or at least they didn't used to. Lately the courts have been getting tougher in tackling smaller projects. It's exactly the smaller projects that would be most calculable, I should think. Sort of. They tend to cancel each other out. There are a lot of red projects, you know, to protect the higher altitudes and any place they can in the south. They've got that constitutional height limit to back them, and so they're always taking their complaints right up to the global court. They win there and do their thing, and then all the little development projects are somewhat counterbalanced. It's a nightmare, legally. But they're managing to hold things steady. Well, I think the high altitudes are getting a bit more air and water than they're supposed to. You have to go really high to get away from it. I thought you said they were winning in court. In the courts, yes. In the atmosphere, no. There's too much going on. You'd think they'd sue the greenhouse gas factories. They have, but they've lost. Those gases have everyone else's support. Without them, we'd have gone into an ice age and stayed there. But a reduction in emission levels... Yeah, I know, it's still being fought over. It'll go on forever. True. Meanwhile, the Hellas Sea's sea level had been agreed on. It was a legislative fact, and efforts all around the basin were coordinated to make sure the sea obeyed the law. The whole matter was fantastically complicated, although simple in principle. They measured the hydrological cycle with all its storms and variations in rain and snow, melting and seeping into the ground, running over the surface in creeks and rivers, down into lakes and then into the Hellas Sea, there to freeze in the winter, then evaporate in the summer and begin the whole round again. And to this immense cycle they did what was necessary to stabilize the level of the sea, which was about the size of the Caribbean. If there was too much water and they wanted to draw down the sea level, there was the possibility of piping some of it back up into the emptied aquifers in the Amphitrites Mountains to the south. They were fairly limited in this, however, because the aquifers were composed of porous rock which tended to crush down when the water was first removed, making them difficult or impossible to refill. In fact, spill-off possibilities were one of the main problems still facing the project. Keeping the balance. And this kind of effort was going on all over Mars. It was crazy, but they wanted to do it, and that was that. Diana was talking now about the efforts to keep the Argyre Basin dry, an effort in its way as large as the one to fill Hellas. They had built giant pipelines to evacuate water from Argyre to Hellas, if Hellas needed water, or to river systems that led to the North Sea, if it didn't. What about the North Sea itself? Maya asked. Diana shook her head, mouth full. Apparently, the consensus was that the North Sea was beyond regulation, but basically stable. They would just have to watch and see what happened, and the seaside towns up there take their chances. Many believe that the North Sea's level would eventually fall a bit as water returned to the permafrost or was trapped in one of the thousands of crater lakes in the southern highlands. Then again, precipitation and runoff into the North Sea was substantial. The southern highlands were where the issue would be decided, Diana said. She called up a map onto her wrist pad screen to show Maya. Watershed construction co-ops were still wandering around installing drainage, running water into Highland creeks, reinforcing riverbeds, excavating quicksand, which in some cases revealed the ghost creek beds of ancient watersheds below the fines. But mostly their new streams had to be based on lava features or fracture canyons, or the occasional short canal. The result was very unlike the Venus clarity of Terran watersheds, a confusion of little round lakes, frozen swamps, canyon arroyos, and long straight rivers with abrupt right-angle turns or sudden disappearances into sinkholes or pipelines. Only the refilled ancient riverbeds looked right. Everywhere else the terrain looked like a bomb range after a rainstorm. Many of the Deep Waters veterans who hadn't directly joined the Hellas Sea Institute had started an associated co-op of their own, which was mapping the groundwater basins around Hellas, measuring the return of water to the aquifers and the underground rivers, figuring out what water could be stored and recovered, and so on. Diana was a member of this co-op, as were many of the people in Maya's old office. After their lunch, Diana went to the rest of the group and told them about Maya's return to the town. When they heard that Maya was interested in joining them, they offered her a position in the co-op with a reduced joining fee. Pleased at the compliment, she decided to take them up on it. So she worked for the Aegean Water Table, as the co-op was called. She got up in the mornings and made coffee and ate some toast or a biscuit or croissant, a muffin or crumpet. In fine weather, she ate out on their balcony. More often, she ate in the bay window at the round dining table, reading the Odessa Messenger on the screen, noting every little incident that combined to reveal to her the darkening situation vis-a-vis Earth. The legislature in Mangala elected the new executive council, and Jackie was not one of the seven. She had been replaced by Nanidi. Maya whooped, and then read all the accounts she could find and watched the interviews. Jackie claimed to have declined to run. She said she was tired after so many M years and would take a break like she had several times before and be back. A sharp glint to her eye with that last remark. Nanidi kept a discreet silence on that topic, but he had the pleased, slightly amazed look of the man who had killed the dragon, and though Jackie declared that she would continue her work for the Free Mars Party apparatus, clearly her influence there had waned, or else she would still be on the council. So, she had bowled Jackie off the global playing field, but the anti-immigrant forces were still in power. Free Mars still held its supermajority alliance in uneasy check. Nothing important had changed. Life went on. The reports from pullulating Earth were still ominous. Those people were going to come up after them someday. Maya was sure of it. They were getting along among themselves. They could rest, take a look around, make some plans, coordinate their efforts. Better, really, to eat breakfast without turning the screen on if she wanted to keep her appetite. So she took to going downtown and having a larger breakfast on the Corniche with Diana, or later Nadia and Art, or with visitors to town. After breakfast, she would walk down to the AWT offices near the eastern end of the seafront, a good walk in air that each year was just the slightest bit saltier. At AWT, she had an office with a window and did what she had done for Deep Waters, serving as liaison with the Hellas Sea Institute and coordinating a fluctuating team of aerologists and hydrologists and engineers, directing their research efforts mostly in the Hellespontus and Amphitrites Mountains, where most of the aquifers were. She took trips around the curve of the coast to inspect some of their sites and facilities, going up into the hills, staying often in the little harbor town of Montepulciano, on the southwest shore of the sea. Back in Odessa, she worked through the days and quit early and wandered around the town shopping in used furniture stores or for clothes. She was getting interested in the new styles and their changes through the seasons. It was a stylish town, people dressed well, and the latest styles suited her, She looked rather like a smallish elderly native with erect, regal carriage. Often she arranged to be out on the Cornish in the late afternoon, walking home to their apartment, or else sitting below it in the park, or having an early meal in the summers in some seaside restaurant. In the fall, a flotilla of ships docked at the wharf and threw out gangplanks between the ships and charged entry for a wine festival with fireworks over the lake after dark. In the winter, the dusk fell on the sea early, and the inshore water was sometimes sheeted with ice and glowing with a pastel of whatever clear color might be filled a circle in an adjoining alley, and between the dusk and the spots on the planks of the temporary stage, the quality of light was such that Maya was drawn like a moth to watch. She barely followed the play, but some moments struck her with great force, especially the blackouts when the action was supposed to stop, the actors all frozen on stage in the late light. That moment only needed some blue, she thought, to be perfect. Afterward, the theater company came over to the restaurant to eat, and Maya talked with the director, a middle-aged native woman named Latrobe, who was interested to meet her, to talk about the play and about Brecht's theory of political theater. Latrobe proved to be pro-Terran, pro-immigrationist. She wanted to stage plays that made the case for an open Mars and for assimilating the new immigrants into the Areophany. It was frightening, she said, how few plays of the classical repertory reinforced such feelings. They needed new plays. Maya told her about Diana's political evenings in the Anta years, how they had sometimes met in the parks, about her notion concerning the blues and the lighting of that night's production. Latrobe invited Maya to come by and talk to the troupe about politics, and also to help with the lighting if she wanted, which was a weak point in the company, having had its origin in the very same parks Diana's group had used to meet in. Perhaps they could get out there again and do some more Brechtian theater. And so Maya dropped by and talked with the troupe, and over time, without ever really deciding to, she became one of its lighting crew, helping also with costumes, which was fashion in a different way. She also talked to them long into the nights about the concept of a political theater and helped them to find new plays. In effect, she was a kind of political aesthetic consultant. But she steadfastly resisted all efforts to get her on stage, not only from the company, but from Michelle and Nadia as well. "No," she said, "I don't want to do that. If I did, they would immediately want me to be playing Maya Teutovna in that play about John." "That's an opera," Michelle said. "You'd have to be a soprano." Nevertheless, she did not want to act. Everyday life was enough. But she did enjoy the world of the theater. This was a new way of getting at people and changing their values, less wearing than the direct approach of politics, more entertaining, and perhaps in some ways even more effective. Theater in Odessa was powerful. Movies were a dead art. The constant, incessant oversaturation of screen images had made all images equally boring. What the citizens of Odessa seemed to like was the immediacy and danger of spontaneous performance, the moment that would never return, never be the same. Theater was the most powerful art in town, really, and the same was true in many other Martian cities as well. So as the M years passed, the Odessa troupe mounted any number of political plays, including a complete run-through of the work of the South African Athol Fugard, searing passionate plays anatomizing institutionalized prejudice, the xenophobia of the soul. The best English-language plays since Shakespeare, Maya thought. And then the troupe was instrumental in discovering and making famous what was later called the Odessa Group, a half-dozen young native playwrights as ferocious as Fugard, men and women who in play after play explored the wrenching problems of the new Issei and Nisei and their painful assimilation into the Areophany. A million little Romeos and Juliets, a million little blood knots cut or tied. It was Maya's best window into the contemporary world, and more her way of speaking back to it, doing her best to shape it. Very satisfying indeed, as many of the plays caused talk, sometimes even a furor, as new works of the group attacked the anti-immigrant government that was still in power in Mangala. It was politics in a new mode, the most satisfying she had yet encountered. She longed to tell Frank about it, to show him how it worked. In those same years, as the months passed two by two, La Trobe mounted any number of vivid productions of the classics, and as Maya watched them, she got more and more snared by the power of tragedy. She liked doing the political plays, which, angry or hopeful, tended to contain an innate utopianism, a drive for progress. But the plays that struck her as most true and moved her most deeply were the old Terran tragedies. And the more tragic, the better. Catharsis, as described by Aristotle, seemed to work very well for her. She emerged from good performances of the great tragedies, shattered, cleansed, somehow happier. They were the replacement for her fights with Michel, she realized one night, a sublimation, he would have said, and a good one at that. Easier on him, of course, and more dignified all around, nobler. And there was that connection to the ancient Greeks as well, a connection being made in any number of ways all around Hellas Basin, in the towns and among the ferals, a neoclassicism that Maya felt was good for them all, as they confronted and tried to measure up to the Greeks' great honesty, their unflinching look at reality. The Oresteia, Antigone, Electra, Medea, Agamemnon, which should have been called Clytemnestra, those amazing women reacting in bitter power to whatever strange fates their men inflicted on them, striking back, as when Clytemnestra murdered Agamemnon and Cassandra, first telling the audience how she had done it, and then at the end staring out into the audience, right at Maya. "Enough of misery! Start no more! Our hands are red! Go home and yield to fate in time before you suffer! We have acted as we had to act." This ends side one of cassette 18. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.